Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 367, titled, What's Going On Here, Part 2, subtitled, Networking, Part 3. This is being recorded on July 7th of the year 2002. We're going to be continuing with discussion of some of the institutional connections underlying not only the events of September 11th, but what has taken place since. As I've indicated in the past, I believe this conflict is literally an extension of World War II, with the United States and some of its allies being basically attacked politically, economically, and through the terrorist milieu, militarily, by what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground, and its Islamo-fascist allies. I know this is a complex concept. That's why I've spent so much time dealing with these very, very devastating events. Points to remember: the intersection of military power, economic power, and political power, particularly as it regards the use of covert action and covert political activity. We're going to look at that intersection between political, economic, and military power throughout the course of this broadcast. Also bear in mind that frequently elements that are involved in a conspiratorial milieu may have been initially involved in that milieu for purposes or for motivations other than those that are being envisioned by the conspirators. One of the key words here is compromising, and also don't forget the concept of manipulation. For background reading for this section, I would recommend, for this program, I should say, I would recommend not only The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, but The Art of War by Sun Tzu, and also On War by Karl von Clausewitz. In order to understand the oscillations that some of the post-war fascist international have engaged in, and a concept we're going to be discussing in the next couple of broadcasts, also Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, an encyclopedic and vital work by Kevin Coogan. We'll be getting to that later. Now, networking and a thematic operational continuity with an organization that we looked at considerable length and among other broadcasts, For the Record 361. That law firm is Sullivan & Cromwell, a powerful Wall Street law firm now somewhat eclipsed, but perhaps making a bid for renewed power. And we're going to take a look at Sullivan & Cromwell. We're going to review an element from For the Record 361. This is in the book Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden. It's authored by Peter Bergen and published in soft cover by Touchstone Books, ISBN number 0-7432-0502-2. Saudi Bin Laden Group is the construction arm of the very powerful Bin Laden Empire, and Sullivan & Cromwell has been its legal counsel. Furthermore, the family company maintained a satellite office in Maryland during the 1990s, employs a public relations agency in Manhattan, and receives legal advice from the white shoe law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. Of course, Sullivan and Cromwell's two best-known partners, Allen and John Foster Dulles, both heavily involved with the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that helped to finance fascism, and also deeply involved with American politics. In For the Record program 366, among other broadcasts, we took a look at the role of Allen Dulles and other movers and shakers from American business and financial communities in helping to interdict Operation Safe Haven. Operation Safe Haven was the U.S. Treasury Department / intelligence operation aimed at interdicting the flight of Nazi capital to neutral countries during and after World War II. That interdiction was unsuccessful, and what coalesced out of that flight capital was, of course, the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization that I've spoken about in the past, and its deadly intelligence component under Heinrich Mueller. Bearing in mind the role of Dulles, among others, in the frustration of Operation Safe Haven, one of the things that's worth noting in connection with the war on terrorism with September 11th is the very important role of financial conduits that are either illegal or marginally legal. In particular, Switzerland as a tax haven and a secretive banking center, the Cayman and Channel Islands. Also, the Clearstream network that we spoke about in For the Record 356, 357, and 359, as well as number 360. We'll talk more about that later. One of the things that complicates the whole issue of the war on terror, as it complicated the issue of purging fascism from Europe, was the fact that the political forces overlap some very, very powerful economic relationships. The interdiction of those economic relationships has often been confused with the interdiction of the political relationships. We talked about that in number 366. I don't think it requires a great deal of extrapolation to see an ominous parallel between the interdiction of Operation Safe Haven by Alan Dulles and his milieu and attempts now by the U.S. financial services to weaken the economic aspect of the war on terror. Point is being walked in these legal negotiations by Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm. Financial Times, Wednesday, July 3rd of 2002, Edward Alden in Washington writes as follows, headlined, "Finance Sector Hits It Move to Curb Terror Funds." This reads in part as follows. The U.S. financial services industry has launched its first serious challenge to the slew of new regulations from Washington aimed at staunching the flow of funds to terrorist groups. The concerns, spelt out this week by 11 industry trade groups representing nearly every major U.S. financial institution, cast serious doubt on the U.S. administration's plans to implement the most important of those regulations by a July 23rd deadline. They could also mark the beginning of a split between the government and industry over just how much new regulation is needed to discourage financing of terrorist groups. The Treasury Department wants all banks and other financial groups to set up elaborate schemes to monitor correspondent and private banking accounts opened in the U.S. by foreign banks or individuals. These are thought to be a main conduit for dirty money flowing into the U.S. financial system. However, the groups, which include the American Bankers Association, the Securities Industry Association, and the New York Clearinghouse, said in a letter on Monday that the plans would be costly and unworkable. They urged the Treasury to support a narrower approach aimed at identifying and scrutinizing a much smaller number of high-risk, unquote, accounts. Skipping down, the rules could also seriously disrupt established financial relationships, the letter warned. In the most extreme instances, financial institutions from a handful of countries such as Russia, the Philippines, and Egypt could be barred from dealing with U.S. banks unless they make available data on all their customers worldwide. Skipping down, note who is handling the legal point work for this economic consortium that is resisting the money laundering rules that are an essential element in neutralizing the funding of terrorism. H. Rajan Cohen, a lawyer with Sullivan and Cromwell who led the effort on behalf of the 11 groups, said the Treasury's definition of risky correspondent accounts was, quote, so broad that they pick up basically all relationships between U.S. financial institutions and foreign financial institutions. Skipping down. The dissent comes at a time when the U.S. effort to crack down on funding for terrorist groups has largely stalled. The campaign is focused on seizing terrorist accounts, and the U.S. and its allies have frozen about $115 million in suspected terrorist assets to date. But the seizures have dried up as terrorist groups have moved their assets out of cash accounts and into commodities such as gold and diamonds, Treasury officials say. The crackdown on terror finance internationally has been accompanied by a sweeping regulatory campaign to tighten anti-money laundering rules domestically, and it is those rules that are being resisted by elements of the financial industry and the legal point work being handled by Sullivan and Cromwell. And again, I don't think it requires a great deal of extrapolation to see an ominous parallel, as well as obviously an institutional theme, running between the interdiction of a safe haven, a Treasury Department operation in the post-World War II years, and what may be the beginning of an interdiction of the money laundering rules essential to neutralize the powerful funding conduits that are behind Al-Qaeda and other Islamist and Islamo-fascist terrorist groups. Now, in terms of analyzing and delineating the history of these powerful elements, one element that I think I've been perhaps a bit negligent in reminding people about is the fact that John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, the two partners from Sullivan and Cromwell that we've looked at many times, most recently in For the Record 361, they became, under President Eisenhower, the Secretary of State and Director of the CIA. John Foster Dulles was Eisenhower's Secretary of State. At the same time, his brother and Sullivan and Cromwell operative, fellow Sullivan and Cromwell operative Allen, was Director of the CIA. At the same time, Richard Nixon, who was a protege of Dulles and who worked on the Crusade for Freedom with Allen Dulles, was Vice President. So you have Nixon as Vice President, Alan Dulles as Director of the CIA, you have John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State throughout Eisenhower's administration, and that led to a huge concretization and consolidation and the fulfillment of the economic, political, military, and intelligence power of the milieu that we're talking about, the Sullivan and Cromwell Dulles Underground Reich milieu. We're going to review the ascension of the Dulles brothers under Eisenhower from the book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. This is a must-read for anyone researching fascism in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods. Authored by the brilliant Kevin Coogan, it was published in softcover by Autano Media and copyright 1999. Of the ascension of Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles under Eisenhower, and also the fact that their protege, Frank Wisner, whom we looked at, the suicide of whom, or quote suicide of whom, we looked at in For the Record 366, we read as follows. Now, note the order here is a hypothetical construct created by, or posited by Kevin Coogan here, to deal with some of the governance of the post-war clandestine fascist networks that were set up to survive the Third Reich's military defeat. And these networks oscillated between not only the United States and the West, but also they worked with the former Soviet Union. And I think that playing of both sides off against the middle is one of the things that needs to be taken into consideration in analyzing the history of the Cold War. Dulles, John Foster and Allen, Frank Wisner and Eisenhower. The reference to the strategy of tension is a terrorist program that was realized in Italy, among other places, in which right and left-wing terror was managed by elements of the state utilizing fascist organizations. Behind the strategy of tension, there lurked what appears to have been a devil's pact between the Order and Alan Dulles. Until Dulles was named CIA director by President Eisenhower and his brother, John Foster Dulles, became Secretary of State, operational links to the Nazi underground came primarily from the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, headed by Dulles' protege Frank Wisner, the former chief of OSS operations in Bucharest, Romania. After the war, Dulles, Frank Wisner, former CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton, and the OPC's Carmel Offey virtually ran covert operations in Italy as their own private affair. The OPC's budget was $4.7 million in 1949. 3 years later, when Dulles was still only CIA deputy director, it had reached $82 million. OPC personnel had jumped from 302 to 6,954. OPC was officially incorporated into the CIA in 1952 as the agency's Directorate of Plans. In 1956, after President Eisenhower established the Killian Commission to investigate the agency, it was discovered that more than half of the CIA's personnel and 80% of its budget had been devoted not to intelligence gathering but to psychological and political warfare programs. Throughout this entire time, the Dulles network was intimately involved in complex deals with various factions inside the post-war SS. And we're going to take a look now at the concretization of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. We looked at this in 356 and 357, among other programs. In addition to ex-Nazis and fascists, and perhaps ex belongs in quotes, in the 1980s, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization embraced Islamists as well, Muslim fundamentalists, who were being utilized in various capacities in a number of the Middle Eastern countries. Islamic fundamentalists were elevated as an anti-communist force, or a force against the left. I would note that it was as a force against the left and as a force against what was perceived as domestic Jewish power that many of these Nazis and fascists were brought into the United States. And I would note that anti-communism and the desire to counterbalance what was perceived as inordinate Jewish political influence in the United States was one of the elements that moved this milieu not only to utilize Islamists or Islamo-fascists and many of these ex-Nazis and fascists against the Soviet Union and against the left, but they were also utilized domestically as a counter-Jewish force, quote-unquote, as well. Secret War Against the Jews, How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. John Loftus, the former Justice Department investigator, who was investigating many of these importations of Nazis and fascists into the U.S. in connection with intelligence operations. Now, again, note the milieu of the Dulles brothers and Richard Nixon, later Ronald Reagan and William Casey. This is by way of review. The truth was quite sordid. With the help of the Dulles-Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. The cover-up had been going on for a long time before Angleton censored the Vatican files, but the Australians inadvertently had let a tiny corner of the story out of the bag. Although we explore the Republican-Nazi connection in chapters 10 and 13, it's important for the reader to understand the size of the scandal that Angleton was trying to bury. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language-speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. By the way, the Crusade for Freedom, an illegal domestic intelligence operation that embraced both of these elements, had as one of its key people Arthur Bliss Lane, who also was a key Republican campaign official in the 1952 Republican campaign. So anti-communism and domestic anti-Jewish action, a twin motive both for the involvement of Nazis and fascists and Islamo-fascists into not only the U.S. intelligence system, or at least as ostensible allies of the U.S. intelligence system, but also this embraced their incorporation into the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Quote, displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program, and as vice president, he even received Eastern European fascists in the White House, skipping down. In 1968, Nixon promised that if he won the presidential election, he would create a permanent ethnic council within the Republican Party. Previously, the ethnic division was allowed to surface only during presidential campaigns. Nixon's promise was carried out after the 1972 election during George Bush's tenure as chairman of the Republican National Committee. And reviewing some of the key people involved with this milieu, in addition to Richard Nixon and Alan Dulles, skipping ahead in Secret War Against the Jews, as a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an OPC front named the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters campaign. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And again, note that William Casey became Nixon's SEC chief. Note that William Casey was very close to Prescott Bush Sr., as was Richard Nixon, and Richard Nixon very close to the elder George Bush as well. Now, noting the incorporation of Islamists, including people overlapping the milieu of Al-Taqwa, into the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, I spoke about that at length, and For the Record programs 356 and 357, and the annotation of much of the text from those programs will be incorporated into the annotated description for program 367 as well. One of the areas overlapping the milieu of the Islamists on the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization and the Funny Money Networks, including the networks involved with the BCCI and the Clearstream Network, is Harkin Energy, one of whose directors that we looked at in For the Record 356 was Talat Atman, a Bush family ally who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican Convention in 2000. Harkin Energy has recently been in the news, as have George Bush's dealings with it. San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, July 4th, Zachary Coyle of the Chronicle writes, "Story changes on Bush stock sale," and this is about the Harkin Energy deal. Skipping down, the controversy involves Bush's sale of shares of stock in Harkin Energy Company, an oil and gas exploration company. Bush had acquired shares in the company and joined its board in the mid-1980s when Harkin bought his money-losing energy firm, Spectrum 7. On June 22, 1990, Bush sold 212,140 shares of Harkin stock just 2 months before the company reported a $23 million loss. At the time he sold, the stock price was $4, but by the end of the year, it had fallen to $1 a share. There are changing stories about just why Bush was filing some of the documents late. I would also note that this controversy involves the capital Bush used to buy into the Texas Rangers, skipping down. The controversy bubbled to the surface again this week after the release of a 1991 SEC memo showing that Bush was late in filing four Form 4s for sales of Harkin stock worth $1,028,935. Bush used $600,000 of money from the sales to buy part ownership of the Texas Rangers baseball team. And as this article notes, Bush's father was president at the time. One of the organizations representing some of the Islamists on the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization that we looked at in For the Record 356 and 357, and again the documentation will be reproduced in the description for 367, that's the American Muslim Council. And the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, addressed that recently. Mueller, bear in mind, was in charge of the BCCI investigation, which would have involved Talat Atman had it gone farther than it did. I speculated about some of the many BCCI evidentiary tributaries to September 11th and the events around it in numerous broadcasts. San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, June 28, 2002, Chronicle News Service's story, "Muslims Converge on Capitol Hill in Lobbying Bid." Amid accusations it supports extremists abroad, the American Muslim Council opened its four-day conference Thursday with a lobbying campaign on Capitol Hill to press lawmakers on issues ranging from Palestinian statehood to toughened FBI surveillance tactics. And it was this group that Robert Mueller addressed, skipping down. Critics say the council has urged members in the past to contribute to some charities whose assets have since been frozen by the United States because of links to terrorists. That was the Operation Green Quest, March 20th raids, which netted many of these same elements. Now, one of the things that I want to look at during the last couple of minutes of this side concerns one of the elements of overlap between the Nazis and fascists from Europe on the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization and the Islamist elements as well. And one of the many things that united some of these elements was the former World Anti-Communist League. We're going to take a look now at the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and the concretization of WACL, turning once again to Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan. After World War II, NTS found a new patron in the CIA. The exile group and its journal Pulsev, or SEED, were incorporated into the U.S.-supported Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty complex in Munich. The CIA, British Intelligence, and the Galen Organization, later the BND, tried with mixed success to incorporate groups like NTS and the Ukrainian separatist OUN into the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN. This revamped anti-Comintern then became the European wing of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, or APACL, the precursor organization to the World Anti-Communist League. And one of the elements of WACL was the World Muslim Congress, reviewing briefly, turning once again to Dreamer of the Day. 2 years later, in January 1955, Sadat became the Secretary General of the Grand Mufti's World Muslim Congress. The World Muslim Congress soon developed close ties to CIA-backed organizations like the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, or APACL. It also circulated Henry Ford's anti-Semitic writings and maintained especially good ties with Gerald L. K. Smith. And the World Muslim Congress later was financed by Saudi Arabia and became a key element of the anti-Soviet Afghan War of the 1980s that saw the birth of Osama bin Laden and many elements of al-Qaeda as warriors. Concluding on this side with The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee of the World Muslim Congress, Dr. Inamullah Khan, the head of the WMC, also served as an advisor to the Saudi Arabian royal family, which lavished funds on the WMC. Skipping down. Soon, the World Muslim Congress began working closely with U.S. intelligence and Pakistani military officials who were covertly supporting the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul. This effort was strongly endorsed by Dr. Khan, who served for many years as the Pakistani representative of the Nazi-infested World Anti-Communist League, which played an important role in the Reagan administration's secret war in the Golden Crescent. And we're going to take a look at another element that figured in the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, the ABN, and its overlap with the Free Congress Foundation inside, too. I've alluded to numerous other broadcasts. Those are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email them at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And there are detailed annotated descriptions, also featuring many long excerpts of text. They collectively, the work on September 11th is already book length. Those are available for free in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. In addition, in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there are links to two URLs maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, WFMU.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory has more recent programs streaming on Real Audio. Older programs are available for download only, also on Real Audio, at another URL linked to the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website, which features the two most recent half-hour segments that I've been recorded. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 367, What's Going On Here, part two, Networking, Part 3, being recorded on July 7th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.